Okay.
Shall we get started?
Yes.
Okay.
This one's going to introduce
you.
Hello. Go Paul.
Latecomers.
Fashionably late.
Come in.
Just to maintain his Hindu dignity.
Okay. Please, everyone, take your seats.
Well, I'll close this door over just to...
Yeah.
Please.
Good.
Thank you.
Well, it's, we'd like to welcome Sangeetha Menon. This is her second talk here at the center. And Sangeetha Menon is graduated in zoology, so she's qualified to talk about Darwin, of course, and also qualified to talk about Hinduism. She has a degree in on the concept of consciousness in the Bhagavad Gita. Today she's going to talk about a very interesting topic, especially for people working in science and religion, which there are half of the people here working in science and religion, Gopal and I. So
this is here. I'm past science.
And she's
science.
And Gary's transcended science, so.
It's only me. It's
wonderful.
It's only me who's in my life.
And Vaisheshika is also science.
It's all on atoms, right?
Yeah. So we're going to be hearing about Darwin's conception of facial expressions as it's compared with texts like Anatta Shastras. Darwin, of course, as we're going to hear, concerned about facial expressions and what that means and how that relates to evolution. So this is a very interesting topic, and we're looking forward to hearing what she has to say. So please take the floor.
Thank you, Jonathan.
You're welcome.
Well, I have some pictures to show, but I guess since we are just few, I might call you near my laptop and you could see.
Okay.
I don't have an
appeal. Did you want a PowerPoint?
It's okay. It's never mind. Yeah. There's few of us. That's fine. And I hope you won't mind me reading this paper since it's a paper. And in between, I would, since so many points I didn't want to miss by remembering things. So thanks, Gopal, Jonathan, and Giri, and Professor Kumar to be here this morning in spite of the rain.
Mm.
And really got a taste of the English weather this morning. I was a bit nervous that whether I'll be able to make it. I didn't have an umbrella nor a raincoat, but then fortunately I found that I did have a raincoat. Okay. The scientific study, I qualify it as scientific study, the scientific study of the facial expression of emotion began with Darwin's publication of his book, The Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals. He published it in 1872. I said scientific study because there has been studies in our tradition, Hindu tradition, and perhaps in other Eastern traditions too. Among his many extraordinary contributions, Darwin gathered evidence that some emotions have a universal facial expression. He cited examples, published pictures, suggesting that emotions are evident in other animals too, and he proposed principles explaining why particular expressions occur for particular emotions. The principles which he maintained that is the reason for expressions in all animals. Perhaps in dramaturgy or aesthetics, that's something which is not done. You don't ask why such an expression. You say this expression. Well, a couple of ideas which he argued in this book, The Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals. One is that emotions are not unique to humans, but it can be found in many species.
Mm.
And that many of the same social occasions that generate emotions in humans do so in other animals. So you're not privileged. He asked why this particular expression for a particular emotion, and his answer formed part of his demonstration of the continuity of the species and was thus crucial to his evolutionary theory. The book Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals was published 13 years after The Origin of Species, which was published in 1859, and 1 year after The Descent of Man, 1871. It's just a little background. He originally intended this book to be a chapter in The Descent of Man, but then it grew too long. But he has started keeping the notes that formed the basis of his book since 1830s. One of the major ideas which he suggested is that muscles that are difficult to voluntarily activate might escape efforts to inhibit or mask expression, revealing true feelings. And this is especially concerning the facial muscles. A man when moderately angry, this is to quote Darwin, or even when enraged, may command the movements of his body, but those muscles of the face which are least obedient to the will sometimes alone betray a slight and passing emotion. He also said that people can command the movements of the body when angry and presumably in any other emotion, and therefore bodily movement, unlike the reliable facial muscles, should be easy to conceal. He argued that emotions are not unique to humans but can be found in many species. Even bees get angry, B-E-E-S. It's only in recent years, but those studying animal behavior have stopped shying away from the danger of anthropomorphism to recognize Darwin's wise observations that many of the same social occasions that generate emotions in humans do so in other animals. He asked a question that few before or after him have asked. It is not just what expression occurs, not just when an expression occurs, although he did address these questions. He also asked why this particular expression for a particular emotion. His demonstration of the continuity of the species, that emotions are not unique to humans, which was crucial to his evolutionary theory, came from his answer to why this expression question. He described three explanatory principles. According to the principle of serviceable habits, you can look at it, we can discuss it later in detail, actions that originally had some usefulness would be preserved as signals. For example, the retraction of the upper lip in a canine, exposing teeth preparatory for biting, was preserved as a display of the size of the weapon that might be used. In similar fashion, the dog stands erect, hair on its back upright, to appear large and thus threatening. To explain why the dog slinks with back down and close to the ground when affectionate or submissive, Darwin invoked his principle of antithesis, and this is exactly the opposite of the moments of the serviceable habits, opposite of the moments of aggression. Some of the expressions Darwin said that which cannot be explained by either these two, serviceable acts or antithesis, he said that this is of the direct action of the nervous system. His book is a compendium of fascinating observations about the expressions of humans and other animals. Like he said, that we purse our lips when we concentrate on doing something such as threading a needle. We open our mouth when listening intently. Okay, nobody is doing that. We want to touch with our faces.
We have evolved.
we want to touch with our faces, those we love. We can bite affectionately as do other animals, and so on almost endlessly. Okay, this is a picture of an Englishman who is aggressive, and he got a lot of pictures of English men and women with various emotions. It's from Darwin's book.
I think he has a lot of pictures of his wife in there too, isn't he? I think some of them are fine.
It's just this dog similar. Okay. Okay, I think I'll stop Darwin there, but it'd be fascinating to read that book if you could get it. It's also downloadable from the net. It's freely available in the net. Okay, now coming to Paul Ekman. How many of you have heard of Paul Ekman?
A little bit?
Yeah. Okay. I'll tell him a little more about him as we go along. But first let me say that Darwin didn't work on basic emotions or the listing of emotions per se. For him it was rather giving a naturalistic explanation of certain emotions he thought had an evolutionary advantage. Ekman also became famous because of his interest in taxonomy, like many other Indian traditions and Indian texts. Ekman lists 7 basic human emotions, and basic is a technical word which he uses. And these 7 basic human emotions have clear facial signals. And these are anger, sadness, fear, surprise, disgust, contempt, and happiness. He expanded the list of emotions distinguishable from one another, and he had about 15 emotions in that list, which are amusement, anger, contempt. This is the larger class of emotions, according to him. Amusement, anger, contempt, contentment, disgust, embarrassment, excitement, fear, guilt, pride in achievement, relief, sadness or distress, satisfaction, sensory pleasure, and shame. But each of these emotion denote a family of related emotions, and they could be expanded further. It's interesting that romantic or parental love are not included by Ekman, and if you ask him why, he considers that they are more enduring than emotions, though they are highly emotional laden. Because according to Ekman, emotions are something which happens and goes in a few seconds. He actually illustrates. He says that, I don't just feel happy with my daughter. Sometimes I'm worried, sometimes I'm surprised, and sometimes I might feel anger. It's an attachment, not a fleeting emotional state. A mood is different still. It doesn't last as long as an attachment, though it can last for hours or even longer. So these are, to Ekman, emotional plots, more enduring than the basic emotions, specific contexts in which a number, but not all of the basic emotions can be expected to occur. Why Ekman uses the adjective basic to emotion? It's to indicate the view that emotions evolved for their adaptive value in dealing with fundamental life tasks, an idea again inspired by Darwin. And they last for very short durations, unlike complex emotions. Basic emotions last for very short durations. And he distinguishes basic emotions from other affective phenomena such as moods or emotional traits. Emotional expressions are crucial to the development and regulation of interpersonal relationships. To mention just 3 examples, facial expression should be involved in the formation of attachments in infancy as well as in courtship, and in the regulation, acceleration, and or deceleration of aggression. We know that in real life. Not only can there be emotion without expression, there can be what appears to be expression without emotion. That's interesting. Humans can deliberately or habitually fabricate a facsimile of an emotional expression, facially and vocally. And he gives a very clear definition of how to distinguish between a real smile which comes from the heart and the smile which comes from the lips, which we will, if interested, we can talk about it later. Okay, I'm trying to move a little fast because we can finish and then have some discussion too. Emotions can occur with a very rapid onset through automatic appraisal with little awareness and with involuntary changes in expression and physiology. We often experience emotions as happening to us. Emotions are unbidden, not chosen by us. Specific emotions regulate the way in which we think, and that this will be evident in memories, imagery, and expectations. The relationship between emotions and thoughts is not solely a function of social learning because of biological constraints put on the cognitive system as well as the emotion system. The subjective experience of emotion, how each emotion feels, is for some at the center of what an emotion is. This is interesting that Ekman deviates a little bit from Darwin to accept the subjective nature of emotion and sometimes how the subjective nature of emotion could in turn provoke something which is more physical or biological. There's another idea for which Paul Ekman is very well known and because of which he's very rich. This is called the micro expressions of face. Ekman, through close study, learned that micro-expressions lasting less than 1/5 of a second may leak emotions someone wants to conceal. By the way, Ekman was a student of Sylvan Tompkins, who featured prominently in Malcolm Gladwell's book Blink, if you've heard of the book Blink. Ekman famously cataloged the thousands of possible combinations of facial muscles position that form expressions. The resulting techniques he developed to read micro-expressions, and they're outlined in several of his popular books, including Emotions Revealed, Recognizing Faces and Feelings to Improve Communication and Emotional Life, Telling Lies Close to Deceit in the Marketplace, Politics and Marriage. Apart from micro-expressions, there are 7 characteristics that will be of help in distinguishing voluntary from involuntary facial expressions. These are 7 characteristics apart from the expressions themselves. And these are, one is the morphology. This is best documented for enjoyment, but the absence of any of the reliable moments should raise questions about whether the expression is voluntary rather than involuntary, and the presence of the reliable actions should suggest that an expression is genuine. The next is symmetry. While tedious to measure and not likely to be detectable in real time, asymmetry is a mark that the expression is deliberate. Duration, very brief, which is half second, and very long, more than 5 seconds, a duration of an atypical expression should occur more often with deliberate than spontaneous expressions. Which means spontaneous expressions are of very small duration. Speed of onset. Although this varies with social circumstances, the onset of a deliberate expression will more often be abrupt than that of a spontaneous expression. Apex overlap. This is the 5th characteristic. In those expressions in which there are multiple independent facial actions, it's likely that the apexes of the actions will overlap if the expression is spontaneous. There has been no research on this suggestion, according to Ekman. The 6th one is ballistic trajectory. The expression will appear smooth over its trajectory without a stepped or jagged offset if it is spontaneous. And the last one is cohesion. The expression will fit with what is being said simultaneously. I think it's most commonsensical. Ekman, by the way, he is a psychologist by training, but he is also a photographer, started photography at the age of 12. And he's 72 now, and he lives in Auckland. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the state and local police forces have turned to Dr. Ekman for help learning to read subtle emotional cues from the faces, voices, and body language of potential assassins, terrorists, and questionable visa applicants. Around the world, more than 500 people, including neurologists, psychiatrists, and psychologists, have learned Dr. Ekman's research tool called FACS, Facial Action Coding System, for deciphering which of the 43 muscles in the face are working at any given moment, even when an emotion is so fleeting that the person experiencing it may not be conscious of it. That detailed knowledge of facial expression has earned Ekman a supporting role in the movie industry, where he has consulted with many animators from Pixar and Industrial Light and Magic to give lifelike expressions to cartoon characters. So that's about Ekman. And the main part of today's talk, at least I want it to be, is Indian dramaturgy, which is not just the study of face or the body language or gesture, but could be considered as a spiritual exercise because it combines theatrics, emotional nuances, and the play of the actor in the stage using a whole lot of complex features, including his or her body. Indian dramaturgy, the foundational text of Indian dramaturgy is, many of you would know, is Natyashastra. It's authored by Bharatamuni. Anyway, no evidence for that. Like many other Indian texts, But the date of this text, again, is debatable, like over many, many, many BC years. It could be any time between 3rd century BC or 1st century AD. But more evidence has showed that it could be more likely 1st century AD. The available form of the text is comprised of 5,600 verses coupled with prose, though the original version is said to have had more than 30,000 verses. It's a complete treatise on Indian dance, drama, and music. The text has an exhaustive thematic structure since it deals with a complex conception of drama, natya, constituted by both objective and subjective features. I say both objective and subjective features because on one hand, there is the description of the characteristics of playhouse, different kinds of plays, different and complex gestures and moments, rules of prosody, meters and music, use of language, style of characters, costumes and ornaments. And on the other hand, there is a discussion on emotions and mental states, which are their causes, the causes of the emotions, mutuality of emotions, mental states, rapport between actor and spectator, mental and physical nature of the actor and spectator, preliminary mystic rituals for effective representation, and the final goals of drama. The final goal of drama, like many other Indian classical texts, is the final goal is spiritual experience. And the spiritual experience is supposed to be happening by an integral combination of the use of the objective use of theatrics and also the involvement of your own body, mind, and spirit. And that's the whole idea of rasa and bhava, which we will look at in a few moments. It's interesting that on one hand, there is a strict structural rigidity as to the epistemological structure of the text. And on the other hand, there is an openness about the subjective expression, relationship between the actor and the spectator, goals of drama, and so on. The rigorous and specified rules of natya, together with an integral approach to emotions, first-person experience of the actor and the spectator, make this text an insightful treatise as well as what could be considered as conceived of as belonging to a higher order of cognition and experience, namely a wholesome re-representation of human emotions through the complex act of external body. The body itself has a wider connotation as far as this text and the theme is concerned. The body would include the physical body gestures, costumes, music, and the plot of the drama. And so it is a representation of the external body as well as the spiritual body. Spiritual body would include emotions, state of mind, and the unique relationship between one who is presenting the re-representation and one who is enjoying it. For a few definitions of what natya means and so on. The word natya, unfortunately or fortunately, does not have a one-word English equivalent. Before we get to the meaning of natya, it's important to keep that this text gives a distinction between three ideas or three expressions, which is one is natya, the other is nritta, and the third one is nritya. Natya, nritya, nritta, viveka. And this is the introductory theme which is discussed in the Natya Shastra. And what is natya? Natya is like in any other classical theatrics. It is a combination of nritya, acting, and dance. Nritya and nritta. Nritya is, it is acting primarily, and it is also the visual and pantomimic representation of emotions and ideas. Nritta refers to the movements of the body with gestures which are regulated by tala, musical time interval. So that's more structural and technical. There's nothing more to it. But nritya has the concept of abhinaya or gestures included into it. And therefore the scope of bringing many nuances of different emotions.
How is natya different from nritya?
Natya is a combination of nritya and nrita. So Natya would include both a structural, rigid steps according to music and also Abhinaya and gestures. Okay, I'm trying to skip a few things. Though the text continues to give a complex definition of what constitutes Natya, the categorical statement made about it is that Natya has primarily to do with Rasa. And that's also something which is of interest to us this morning. Natya is explained later, using two key ideas which are interesting again. One is Abhinaya and the other is Bhava. Natya means, as I said, visual representation in its fourfold forms, such as using parts of the physical body, Ankika, which means using your body, verbal utterances, Vachika, words, costumes and ornaments, the Aharya, and physical signs of mental states. There is a famous verse which represents Shiva as having this fourfold dances by including the cosmos and so on. But later, if you're interested, I can give you what is that verse. What is Abhinaya? Abhinaya is defined as the expression through the actor of the meaning of the words of a literary or a poetical work with the help of emotions and states of mind which could be physically represented. There is a word for it. It's called Vibhava. And this is supposed to invoke an uninterrupted flow of rasa, enjoyment, for the audience. Rasa, in a very straight English translation, could mean relish or taste. The fulfillment of Natya is achieved through the effective and joint performance of different kinds of Abhinaya and Mudra. Mudra is, again, as you would know, the representation of objects, emotions and ideas through single hand or combined hand gestures. I wouldn't go into the number of single hand and combined hand gestures, which are just numerous. There is also the role of a spectator. The role of the spectator is considered to be an active event and mutually influencing the performance of the actor in terms of the representation of feelings. So the spectator is supposed to say a few words, utter a few words, and respond in certain way. So in fact, in Bharata Muni, at one instance says that even the spectator has to be informed. Anybody cannot be a spectator. First of all, he has to be a sakhrudaya, one who is endowed with a heart, sakhrudaya, and also one who is able to understand what's going on. So some technical details he need to be informed about. And some of his feelings should be naturally invoked also by seeing what's happening. And so it's very interesting dynamics. The rasa which is produced by the dancer or the actor should be powerful enough to invoke those particular sounds or voices or nuances of feelings, bhava, from the spectator. So the rasa is supposed to invoke the bhava. Well, there's a lot of subtle discussion on what is rasa and bhava, a lot of debate, but we will not go into that at this moment. But you could only mean, at this point, we could say that rasa is a relish, a taste, which is produced out of a bhava, which can also produce a bhava. It's not only produced out of, but in turn, it can also produce. So that's why when a dancer or an actor produces a particular rasa, the spectator could be having an empathetic relation with what is being portrayed in the stage. Okay. In this text, it's interesting that, as I said in the beginning, there are two parallel discussions that goes on. One is the discussion on a different kinds of the structural rigidity of the body, the stage, the playhouse, and the poetry, and so on, the music, the meter, and so on. And on the other hand, there is detailed discussion and description of rasa, emotions, and bhava, mental state, pure mental states, which produces emotions. And then the discussion between mental rapport between the actor and the spectator, the types of characters and mental and physical temperament for their portrayal, the goals of drama and how they are fulfilled, and so on. We could say that the concept of Natya evolves in the text through the development of both third-person and first-person approaches. As I said in the beginning, to illustrate that there is a combination of the cosmic and the individual in the representation of rasa, the famous verse which reminds you of Shiva as Nataraja, knows the cosmic dancer, says that the cosmogony, that the physical world, is the Ankika Abhinaya of Shiva. The physical world is the Ankika Abhinaya of Shiva. Is Vachika Abhinaya, is words, is the world of language, and is Aharya Abhinaya, consists of, Aharya is the costumes, consists of the universe, and his Sattvika Abhinaya is the ultimate happiness itself. The complexity of representing human emotions and at the same time invoking empathy in the spectator is brought out through Natya in a comprehensive manner using a rigorous epistemology and first-person experience for both actor and the spectator. Natya is though presented following a structured design about it through the portrayal of characters. The primary nature of Natya is experiential and first-person oriented. This is evidenced by the detailed discussion on rasa, bhava, and prekshagatva. The word Natya has its origin from the root nat, which means to act. Nada is one who performs the act through different styles of abhinaya. Natya is the art of nada. The importance given to Natya as a dramatic art has its origin in the act itself of the actor. It is the nada who is responsible for Natya and not vice versa, which focuses on the subjective nature of it. Let's look at rasa for a moment. Rasa is a complex concept which is the central idea on which the experience of Natya is founded. As I said earlier, the word rasa is variously translated as relish, enjoyment, and related to mean the object of relish or relish itself. It could mean that which produces relish or the experience of relish itself. According to Bharata Muni, rasa emerges out of the combination of three basic components such as vibhava, anubhava, and vyabhichari. I think I will not go into those details at this point. But we could understand that there are what is called as the determinant, consequent, and auxiliary conditions of rasa. And all these three together taken are called as the sthayi bhava, which is responsible for the production of rasa. In Natya Shastra, bhava is used as a technical word to relate to the mental states which are responsible for producing rasa for the spectator through a combination of kinds of abhinaya, or gestures. Whether rasa is produced through bhava or vice versa, or whether they are mutually influenced, is a debate which is prominent in the literature on Natya Shastra by various commentators, which we will not go into. For this discussion, I will deal only with the detailed presentation of the kinds of rasa and bhava, one instance of abhinaya, which is that of eyes, drishti, and the nature of effectiveness of natya, natya siddhi nirupana, to show that the importance given to the nuances and details of mental states, basic nature of experience, and their physical representations, with an attempt to give a third-person account of the first-person experience. The text goes into a whole lot of detail with sometimes micro detail into expressions. But today we will see some of these details about drishti or glances, which that could be of interest to all of us in our day-to-day life. But before that, let me say that Bharata enlists 8 rasas as the primary rasa and a total of 49 bhavas, which are classified as Sthayi Bhava, eight Sthayi Bhava, 33 Vyabhichari Bhava, and 8 Sattvika Bhava. Friends, you should remember that Natya Shastra, like any other classical Indian text, is very interested in taxonomy. Sometimes it can just engulf you in the taxonomical details that you forget what is actually being discussed. So I will not get into the taxonomy this morning, but please keep in mind that this text goes into such details to enlist 49 mental states. But this may not correspond to the basic emotions, which Ekman says, because some of these mental states even includes moods and mental dispositions and so on. By the way, you might remember that Patanjali also talks about a variety of mental states and emotions, but that's for another day. Okay, just to give a description of shoka, the rasa shoka, the cause and effect of the sthayi bhava of shoka is produced by the mental state of shoka. The primary state of shoka, which as an emotion, is produced by the vibhava, the causal factor, such as in this text, separation from the beloved, loss of dear ones and assets, etc. Shoka is represented by the anubhava. Anubhava is the physical representation of the state, such as tears, deep sighs, and so on. It is the sthayi bhava which is the pure mental state, which plays the key role in creating the rapport between the actor and spectator through the production of rasa, which means the actor or the dancer will have to go through a sthayi bhava, would have to actually experience it in order to produce what could be that experience for a spectator. The spectator won't be able to experience it unless the actor or the dancer herself or himself goes through it. Now, Bharata enlists 8 fundamental sthayi bhavas, which are the 8 fundamental or primary mental states. And as I said earlier, 33 vyabhichari bhava, 8 sattvika bhava, and 8 rasa. But let us see the rasa and the sthayi bhava, the feelings which are generated and the states which produces them. First one, many of you would know this, but let's remind us of this. Radhi, happiness, which is produced by shrinkara or charm. Hasa, laughter, produced by hasya, humor. Shoka, mental pain, produced by karuna or compassion. Krodha, anger, which is produced by rudra or fury. Utsaha, enthusiasm, produced by veera or heroism. Bhaya, fear, produced by bhayanaka, that which is terrifying. Jugupsa, disgust, produced by, that is, bipatsa, or despicable. Vismaya, amazement, produced by adbhuta, or surprise. I will not go into the vyabhichari bhava, but if at all you would be interested, just to enumerate a few, he goes on to list nirveda, which is disinterest, glani, tiredness, shanka, apprehension, asuya, insecurity, which most of which Ekman would have enlisted as a composite of emotional states. Okay. If you are interested to see some of this this is the famous Kalamandalam Gopi. He's a famous Kathakali actor. This is Adbhudam, or surprise. Bhayanagam, terrifying. Okay. Pibatsam, disgust. Hasyam, humorous.
Humorous and surprise looks very similar.
It's very similar, yes. That's right. But some nuances with the corner of the lips. Karunam, compassion. you should also remember that these emotions, as far as the theatrics are concerned, they are kind of accentuated to produce the similar feelings in others. Raudram, anchor. Shantam, peaceful. And this, of course, is listed only in Abhinaya Dharpana after the advent of Abhinavagupta, because of the Buddhistic influence. The Shantarasa is not included in Natya Shastra. Shrinkara, or charming. Viram, heroic. Okay, that's it. I wanted to show you some of the Ekman pictures, but I guess I will show it a little later. Just to remind you, these are the pictures taken by Ekman. Fear, the first one is fear. You can see it later, when, maybe after the lecture is over. Oops. Fear and... okay, I think I may have to... Sadness. Happiness. Sorry, you can't see it, but I can show you later. And disgust. So, the four emotions, pictures, four emotions here. By the way, when Ekman showed these pictures to various people belonging to various cultures, they could recognize it. And he was not satisfied with that. What he did is, he went to Papua New Guinea, and where people are not exposed to any of these faces, which are more products of cultural nuances. And to his quiet surprise, people were able to recognize American faces, which represented the basic emotions. And then he took back the pictures of the Papua New Guinea four tribes, went back to U.S. and showed people there, and they were able to recognize the faces. So this was one theory that... facial expressions of basic emotions are universal, irrespective of cultural restrictions.
And have they shown any studies whereby babies are able to respond to facial expression? Because that will show that it's more a reflex or a sort of a Darwinian phenomenon whereby they yet haven't been able to or understand their wording, put a word meaning to it.
Right.
But they're able to recognize what happens with the facial expression.
Yeah.
And that would be a good one to, if anybody has done a study, but to see, we can recognize some of the facial expressions on the baby, but how does the baby respond to the facial expression in the parent? Because one of the first things that a baby is almost wired to recognize is a picture of a face rather than a jumbled up picture. If you take, I think there have been some studies in psychology where they've looked at babies, what they are tuned to recognize easily and go towards, pay more concentration, is a humanoid face rather than a jumbled up. You take the same curves and lines, but you jumble them up, they don't like it. But you put a humanoid face, they go to look at it.
Yeah, I think that will be interesting to look at.
Has been done at all to look at...
Well, I'm not sure in some... what detail, but I'm sure there are certain preliminary studies.
Supporting Darwinian's theory even more because they haven't yet had that intellectual development.
Yeah.
To be given an assent, oh, that's not nice.
Right.
You don't do that.
Yeah.
They haven't had the verbal clue as well.
Right. That's right. Okay. Let's to come back to Natya Shastra, and then we will have discussion. I'll finish in a few minutes. I'll shut my mouth in a few minutes. The expression through the physical body in Natya Shastra, Ankika Abhinaya, is classified into three types. One is Shariraja, which is using the body. The other is Mukhaja, facial. And the third is Cheshtakrita, through movements. If you watch a typical classical Indian dance, you would see the combination of all the three. There are certain other divisions which I think we will not go into. Except for one another, which is the division is called as Anka and Ubanka. Anka constitutes the Abhinaya through head, hand, chest, sides, hips and feet, Upanka constitute Abhinaya through eyes, eyebrows, nose, lips, cheeks and chin. The one instance of Abhinaya through Upanka, which I will be listing here in detail, is that of Drishti, glances, since these are more visually representative of Rasa. Okay. Bharata Muni is never in short of number when he describes glances. He talks about 36 kinds of glances. Okay, I think I and you would know maybe one or two or three. And these glances are two kinds. One is rasa drishti, representative of the kind of relish, kind of feeling. And the other is bhava drishti, which is kind of the pure state of the mind. And when he talks about drishti or glance, he goes into a detailed description of the kinds of movements of the pupils, eyelids, and that of the eyebrows. Now, let me tell you what are the eight rasa drishti and what are the nature of the eyebrows. And I will not be able to show you at this moment because it needs a little practice and I don't want to do something which is incorrect. So I'll just read them. Kanta, loving glance, okay, which we all have, which produces rasa, sringara rasa. And what are the glance? The eyebrows are moved. The glance are through the sides of the eyes and the eyes with the intense look as if drinking from the object. Hasya, the humorous glance, which is eyelids are contracted one after the other and the pupils wandering. Karuna, compassionate glance, upper eyelid droops down with tears, pupils wandering, nose ends intense. Ferocious glance, Raudra, both eyelids tremble, pupils are still, red and dry eyes, strained eyebrows. Veera, heroic glance, steady pupils, fully opened and glowing eyes, ends of the eye contracted. Bhayanaka, terrifying glance, raised and motionless eyelids, restless pupils. Disgusting glance, Bibhatsa, eyelids come together with restlessness, unsteady pupils, eyeballs at the corners of the eye. Adbhuta, surprising glance, moist eyes, pupils go in and out alternately, eyelashes slightly contracted, bright corners of the eyes. Well, I can go into many other different kinds of glances, but I think that would be more helpful if we have a printout of this and goes into it detail, or you see of these glances with particular expressions. I think I would stop here. What I wanted to do, actually I wanted to cover a little more. What I wanted to show as far as this text is concerned is that for the spectator, in a secondary level, there is the appreciation of the characters and the theme, and in the primary level, a temporary detachment with her or his self-identity as experienced. And for the actor, in a primary level, it's the complex task of representing a character, an idea, or a nuance of a particular feeling through abhinaya and producing the corresponding rasa. There is a transcendence which is experienced both by the spectator and the actor. For the actor, it has to be both transphysical and transmental because she or he has to go through different kinds of rasas and so on. Natya finally explains to you a complex experience. Since there is a combination of detachment and an active engagement by the use of rasa and abhinaya. Why I wanted to compare Ekman, Darwin and Natyashastra, at least in a preliminary sense, is to show that as far as Natyashastra is concerned, the study of faces and the body and gestures in a whole is an exercise for a spiritual experience, both for the actor and the spectator. So the study of body and the face is not a secluded, alienated exercise. But of course, Darwin and Ekman have more evolutionary points of views when they discuss body and face. So the interesting aspect when you study Natyashastra is that you consider the text as something which would also help you in understanding spiritual, help you in understanding aesthetic experience also as a spiritual experience. But as in many other, sorry to say that, in Western texts, when you look at the facial expressions or even evolutionary explanations of face and body in Ekman and Darwin, you see the enlisting consisting of more of negative expressions than of positive expressions. I'm not saying that's wrong or right, but just to give an example of the difference here. But if one would look at Natyashastra and try to have a dialogue with Ekman and maybe even Darwin, I think that would be a very interesting exercise. Thanks so much.
So, have some time for discussion.
You have to leave at 12,
I have to leave
right?
in a few minutes, but there's some. I think we're supposed technically supposed to end at 12 noon. But if anybody wants to raise some questions,
yeah,
please do.
Questions or comments?
Questions,
or
comments. Floor is open.
First of all, my apologies for being late.
It's okay.
Your lecture partly I absorbed, and it reminded me very much of Malavika. Described in the Malavika Pavitra, how she looked, and she was made as if the teacher wanted her to be like that. It's beautifully described in the verse. I know it, the Malayalam verse, but not Bangya Gandhagal Nintu Chandra Sadrasham Vatram Nadam Sambhujam Tingi Pungi Dingi.
Thank you.
That is a very beautiful description of how a dancer should look, which describes everything, I think.
Yeah, thanks.
I mean, today you have emotions to be recognized. When you look at Darwin and probably Ekman, they're almost saying that certain basic emotion cannot be controlled. They'll give way. And for whatever the biological foundations are, that's how
Excuse
we are
me,
made.
Excuse me, may I correct you if I'm permitted? He doesn't talk about basic emotions to be recognized in people. He talks about micro-expressions, which last for less than one-fifth of a second, so which needs a lot of training and very acute observation. That's where perhaps you or me may not be able to do it unless you're trained in that.
But they have got a biological foundation which cannot be overridden
right.
by the individual. That's what I'm trying to bring in, is that I use the word basic emotion not in the taxonomy of theirs. In other words, however much you try to suppress anger, not show it, there is a micro version of it that'll come out.
Right.
And probably that is because of the way we are wired, to put it in a very common parlance, the way we are wired. But having said that, that could be reflex, and the human beings have the ability that to recognize that we can feel angry, but we don't have to continue feel angry, and we don't have to actually execute any of the physical effects or the physical actions that could follow on with the anger, which would be the difference between in the evolutionary cycle between the animal and the human being. For example, when you take a fox, it goes into a chicken coop and it starts killing, but it can't stop killing, even though all it needs is just one chicken. But it's biologically so wired that once it starts the killing, the frenzy continues for a long time. We humans also have the frenzied action, especially when we go into a group situation and a group behavior. But at some point, we can learn to stop that. I mean, I just thought it was worth bringing that point as a difference in terms of the evolution.
Also, I think as far as humans concerned, a whole lot has now gone into social interactions, social existence, and it's much more than our prey predator, right? So we have evolved so much in a complex sense, in a mentally as well as cognitively, and also socially, I think. So often, even if you would be reluctant to express your anger in a social situation, even if you're angry, it's possible that some of the micro-expressions which Ekman says could give way of your feeling angry.
Yes, it helped, but I have a major problem with Ekman's because, okay, he's been very clever. He studied and he said there's micro-expression.
Mm-hmm.
But is he going to be unforgiving about those micro-expressions?
Mm.
That's my next point. It's the utilization of this knowledge and putting it into the realm of actually working out whether you're going to be a terrorist, whether you're telling the truth, or what you're saying is again taking it to that one step too far where
I agree with
an
that.
Unforgiving
knowledge. I agree with that. I agree with that. I mean, he's a multimillionaire or a billionaire or
it doesn't matter.
Very rich
but
man.
My anger when the chap who asks me totally impossible questions at a visa counter in America could be at the question or something else, but how does he know that it is definitely is or the fact that I'm incredibly uncomfortable over there is the fact that I've had a rotten journey.
Yeah, well, trust me, I just went through that in a Madras embassy.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah,
so what I'm trying to say is that the
but I didn't get angry.
The whole thing
though.
Of lack of trust, you know, you're feeling tired, you're feeling fed up, and you're feeling vulnerable, all of that could have been due to a preceding factor and not to that particular event. My basic point was that it's great to do all this micro study, but the pointlessness of it is when it comes to the application, because I don't know whether how many variables it has taken into account.
Well, I'm not sure. That's why I tried to compare it with Natyashastra, because where the whole exercise is an integral approach to human body, mind, and spirit. Maybe I'll just complete this comment, a response to you. But as far as Ekman is concerned, he is successful. I mean, that we cannot deny, because in a specific field he has relevance and what he has said is relevance. But then to attribute a particular very minute part of your expression or your body to something larger can be problematic, as you said. And to lead that from that to anywhere else, to your larger basic life goals, or to even make judgments about people, that's not the scope of, I think, his study. Which he also agrees, because he is now in a line with Dalai Lama. There's a lot of work going on, so I think he is trying to see perhaps more deeper relevances of his study, or at least if he could make it deeper. In any case,
if I may be permitted to ask that, don't you, as you have also said, don't you feel that the Natyashastra, you have yourself said, it's more integral. So it's a more inclusive and universal study,
right?
Rather than these exclusive and very focused.
Absolutely,
very
absolutely,
focused,
absolutely.
Because the Natyashastra takes into account the Sthayi Bhava and the Vyabhichari Bhava, which keeps on changing. But the Sthayi Bhava is the constant emotion or the feeling. And the second point I would just like to be enlightened about, is it the Sthayi Bhava produced by rasa, or is it the Sthayi Bhava culminating into rasa? So shall it not be proper to say that it is, because the sutra says vibhava anubhava vyabhichari sanyogat rasa nishpatti. So rasa is the culminating point or the result, while Sthayi Bhava is the one of the factors, not the only factor.
I'll just begin with the last point, because this is a very controversial idea,
very,
so I wouldn't go into that.
Yeah.
Which rasa produces bhava, or
bhava
rasa produces?
Yeah.
I think
culminates
maybe after Natyashastra, maybe another 1,000 years,
yeah,
we have debated on that.
Before you respond, the third point I would also
like
to, because I have some problem with the translation of rasa as relish or taste.
Mm.
It doesn't convey the notion.
What's
of
your
rasa
translation?
Aesthetic experience.
Mm, okay.
Because relish and taste gives it a physical kind of notion, which is not very much in consonance with the notion of rasa that we have. Either you retain the term rasa, it's actually the Sanskrit terms are untranslatable.
Right.
That is the problem. Yeah. I always feel.
Okay, so the second point, I'm not sure whether I'll go into that controversy now, whether bhava produces a rasa,
or rasa.
But I can experientially, and also looking at the various verses, not only the verse which you quoted, could say that there seems to be a cyclical connection between bhava and rasa. It's not only that Bhava produces rasa. Rasa can produce bhava too. But I know that this is a very controversial issue and there has been a lot of theories about it. The second point, to translate rasa as relish, definitely it is not going to be an exhaustive translation, but it's going to be a near translation where you could have certain degree of experiential intimacy with that. If I say aesthetic experience, it's not very easy to have a direct relate. When I say aesthetic experience, okay, it becomes a cognitive idea. So as far as rasa is concerned, when you translate it as relish or taste, it gives you some notion or at least some closeness to what that experience could be in its ultimate degree. For example, in Gita also there is the usage of Brahma rasa as the final rasa.
Even before so Gita, we have it in the Upanishad, raso vai
saha.
Yes, rasam yeva ayam labhva anandi bhavati.
So rasa
leads one to bliss.
Yeah.
So rasa is a blissful experience.
Correct.
Actually.
Yeah.
So relish is very physical.
Yeah, relish is physical.
Yeah.
But I personally would like to reduce the distinction or reduce the gap between the physical and the spiritual. So how do you link it?
Yeah.
It's very important to link it, you know. And also when you say taste, it touches your tongue.
Yeah.
And tongue is a very primary organ for you, you know. And anything which is conveyed to the tongue, it seems to you, you understand it at least in the beginning. I'm not saying in the fullest degree, but at least in the degree of the beginning. So I completely agree with you that taste or relish is not a complete
or
translation. Maybe rasa cannot be translated in any language at all. And the first point is, again, I agree with you that Natyashastra definitely is integral.
Yeah.
But that was my whole idea, to bring Ekman and Natyashastra. Natyashastra, to be... if I say in strict terms, Natyashastra deals with theatrics, drama and dance. It has nothing else, it doesn't have anything to do with anything else. But then, I think it is important to have a dialogue between people who are interested in looking at body language and face, even if it is to explain or prove a Darwinian evolutionary point of view. Because if you look at Natyashastra, even if the goal at that time would have been a spiritual experience or even an aesthetic experience and enlisting a whole nuances of different parts of the face and the body, I think there is this taxonomy which is so rich, and there is also the detailed description of the body itself, because there is at least among a few, there is a popular notion of Indian philosophy or Indian test in general, relegating the body into a lower realm and always focusing on the spiritual experience. Definitely that is there. Well, you may not because you are more aware of it.
Yeah.
But that's why I said it's a popular conception of Indian philosophy, perhaps wrongly influenced by Advaita Vedanta, that there is everything is more into a spiritual realm. But it's amazing the details given into body is so much important in this text. So my idea to bring Natyashastra and Ekman and Darwin, first of all, is to give a piece of my mind, because Ekman at one point says that the study of face starts only 200 years, since 200 years. And I wanted to tell him that maybe you should consider looking at Natyashastra. It could be 1,000 or more than 1,000 years old. So that was one idea. But then... having said all this, I would also like to say that it's very important to also look at, with equal respect, a Darwinian point of view, because that helps us to stand on our toes and also not to be swept off by the currents of spiritual ocean, the waves of spiritual ocean. Because sometimes when the experience is so engulfing, the discussion on spiritual experience is so engulfing, we may not have a hold on a plank or something to hold on, where we can converse in a language which is more easy for people from different disciplines. Of course, definitely Ekman is least concerned about spiritual experience or aesthetic experience and so on. But I think it will be interesting to look at, to create a dialogue between these two masterminds, Ekman and Bharata Muni, and how they would have thought about as facial expression. For Bharata Muni, facial expression is something which produces rasa and bhava. It is leading to spiritual experience. For Ekman, it is certainly something different.
it's like wood rasa, you can say it's a subjective experience produced as a result of an objective perception.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's what it is, but from what I can understand,
right,
what you're saying,
right,
it's a subjective experience,
mm-hmm,
produced as a result of an objective,
mm-hmm,
perception.
Mm-hmm.
But then comes in, for example, a few months last year, I went to see a thing called the River Dance,
mm,
and the rhythmic, high kicking, high speed rhythmic movements,
mm,
gives you a sense of feeling, not only in it's the vibrations, the sound, the movement, and the joy on the face of the people who are performing, leaves you with a sense of high.
Mm.
Now that could be regarded as a spiritual experience or a rasa, it's a subjective experience that takes you and allows you to understand an experience that is in itself appears to be pure because it is stimulated within you, and then it continues even in the absence of the objective, of the object.
Mm-hmm.
So rasa could come into that category, something that allows, that stays within you after the object has been removed, or the causal factor even has been removed.
Mm-hmm.
That could be a much better way of expressing rasa.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of this gives us a taste that the ultimate spiritual experience could be better than all of this.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're going for in Bharatanatyam and so on. And you get these rasas and the moods you're going as a part of a spiritual journey.
Mm-hmm.
It's teaching us that you get these lovely feelings even though you stop moving now. You are only experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
The dance is finished. Everything is quiet. The audience are still experiencing. The performer is probably still on a high note.
Yeah.
The Western language would be a high note. But that is a way of a spiritual journey that you can reach that level and probably go beyond,
right,
which the Western Darwinians do not address.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, good point. I agree with you. The only small thing which I would add to it, that in Natya Shastra there is also the usage of detachment and engagement as two active processes in order to gain spiritual experience. For instance, the actor or the dancer has to detach from her real identity,
mm,
and also the identity of a particular role which is played, because as you know that it can go into a series of things. The dancer or the actor at one point can be representing a plant, at some point can represent an animal or a particular emotion itself, or the beholder of an emotion. So she has to go through various identities. So there is all, in one sense, there is a detachment from every identity which is portrayed, and at another point there is also an engagement. So there is a dynamics that happens between detachment and engagement, which is supposed to be giving this rasa as a spiritual experience to the actor, a dancer.
It comes in almost like saying, you know, you use an object or a kind of perception to develop the rasa within you,
mm-hmm,
then you let go of it.
Right.
Because holding on to that means you go back to the object.
Right.
It's almost like a pole vaulter. He needs a pole vault to come
and
to
then to give
height,
it up.
But he has to let go of it.
Absolutely.
If he wants to cross over.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like that. So you're pole vaulting in series.
Yeah.
You're engaging, disengaging,
yeah,
engaging, disengaging.
That's the best example. We use that example for many other things also. Like Guru is like a pole vault, you know, you hang on to him till you reach that maximum point. And then unless you are able to, you know, abandon the pole vault and jump, the final experience is not going to happen. Yeah, that's right.
So here goes Darwin, you've lost it all.
Yeah.
You lost the plot. You started well but lost the plot.
Well, yeah.
But right, what is the future for dance, music,
there is
poetry
a lot of
and all that?
Mm-hmm.
Because they are all related to the nature, waterfall,
right,
rain,
mm-hmm,
plants, animals, mountains,
right,
ocean. When these things are now going to slowly disintegrated.
Ecological.
Well, 1,000 years will come very soon. But so that is my anxiety. What will happen to the Prakriti? And Prakriti goes, all these beautiful things also.
Laya happens.
That's what the Hindu thinkers had envisaged. You see, the Bahya Prakriti and the Anta Prakriti. There was a coordination earlier, but now nobody thinks about this Bahya Prakriti, and they are also not bothered about Anta Prakriti.
That
so it's
verse,
going to Vikriti.
Samudra
according to us,
devi,
not according to
Dharma. Mandide, namo Vishwambare Devi. Padasparsham Shamasumi.
Yeah.
How many Hindus know that?
Yeah.
How many understand the meaning of that? And that
great
is slowly receding.
Yeah.
And it is, I'm a sort of redundant biologist.
You are prehistoric.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yes. So I am very concerned about the way the world is going. We don't have even interest in our own children.
To give you a humorous note, recently I was watching NDTV.
Get NDTV here?
Oh, you can get it if you have a satellite.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pain, NDTV.
Do you have it?
Yes.
So that shows.
No, wait a minute. Let me finish, young man. there was a program where a Westerner was talking to this North Indian priest, Brahmin, and he was saying that, you know, the source of the Ganges they went in, where it was and where it is now. To be the iceberg is
receding.
He said, why wouldn't she recede and go back to where she came from originally? Look at the way we have no respect for each other. We have no respect for the... But it's the way that he visualized and gave
go
the
back.
Reason. As you know, we have lost respect for nature. So naturally, Ganges is also receding. She's getting fed up. Eventually, she won't be here.
We are contributing to
of
that.
Of course we are.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You know what this is, the song?
Yes.
Switched it off 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.